Net Control Operators, and I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. The TechNet meets most Sunday evenings, 8 o'clock. Usually lasts 4 hours these days, 8 o'clock until 12 o'clock local time, New York City, in which ham radio operators come together. The clan gathers and we discuss our favorite hobbies. It's an extremely beneficial hobby, a very educational hobby, which involves wireless technology. We teach each other how all this hardware works, how to make it work better, and how to get more enjoyment out of it. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater type ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. And before you give up the hobby, if you get disappointed with it for some reason, certainly try some of the other 25. The main thing the technical net does is give you a live question and answer period in which people who sign in during the first hour, we make them a soft promise that we try very hard to give them at least a brief answer to their question during the first hour. After the first hour, John goes to the mailbag and tells us, tells us what kind of exciting letters and emails he has received from people who don't yet have their ham license or don't have the right equipment to be able to get to the net yet. This TechNet is a on-the-spot, live question and answer period. We do not, in general, promise you're going to get free technical service during the rest of the week, so to speak. Certainly not written. If you meet some of the guys in the air, of course, that does take place. There's a very large amount of brain power in the New York City metropolitan area, northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York, and Long Island, and we try to tap into that. And everything you hear is 100% accurate the very first time. Don't let that disappoint you. By way of the sort of peer review that takes place, because there's this beautiful website by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, in which everything gets recorded, and various people listen to those recordings, and when errors are discovered, they bring it to our attention, and we correct it. So there is a kind of peer review. You can go to the TechNet recordings for the last 6.5 years, all 4 hours worth of each Sunday night, 6.5 years. So there's thousands of hours of recordings there. You go to the right year, the right month, the right weekend, and the right hourly reel, and download it and play that one back. That particular website that contains all that information is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. So the website is amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you're going to find 6.5 years of recording for the TechNet. A lot of information there. You can look at it chronologically or you can look at it by subject matter. Some of the subjects might have selected out, which are frequent requests like standing wave ratio and decibels and the Smith chart, things like that. Okay. The
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The TechNet does have other methods of interconnect by way of IRLP, Echo Link, and so on. Places like Canada and California and a few other places tap into the various methods by which you can get to it offline and out of the area. And so we sometimes get questions out of the area. Therefore, we should, in between our conversations, always wait for the 4 beeps and maybe 1 or 2 seconds beyond to make sure that all of the hardware gets properly reset so that the people in the outer areas like Jim and Scott up there in Canada, VE3JIW and VE3ZTZ, make sure that they don't get timed out, among others. I hear tell that there are certain communities you can travel through on Sunday evening and the repeater is repeating what you guys are hearing. So be careful what you say. It's been an exciting week. Ham radio had quite a bit to do with it. A large number of hams are always associated with the New York City Marathon, the Boston Marathon, the London Marathon, the Los Angeles Marathon. And although you didn't hear very much about them because you had thousands of law enforcement people involved in that particular event, those ham radio operators were there and did make quite a contribution. They were giving out the orders way downrange from the finish line at the very unusual event. Let me drop it. They were passing the word to the runners at that time that it's time to discontinue the race. Something very unusual has happened downrange, and they'll only be creating more confusion if you continue running this particular race. Messages like that were being passed. The latest couple of issues of QST Magazine, particularly the May issue, had quite a few interesting articles. We'll try to discuss those. Didn't get to them last week. The usual menu here is that for the first hour we give brief answers. After that, John gives us two, three, four questions from the mailbag, people who don't yet have the ability to sign on directly because they don't have the ham license or don't have the right equipment yet. After that, Paul WS2N, who has for, I think, something like 5 years, been giving us the latest information as to what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And something exciting happened along those lines with reference to the TMT, I think it's called 30-meter telescope, that just got approval to be constructed in Hawaii. 30 meters in diameter. That's 98 feet in diameter telescope. We used to think the biggest thing in the world was the Mount Palomar, 200-inch. That's roughly 16 feet. Can you imagine a 98-foot diameter telescope where the mirror is made out of 492 individual panels? What a machine. That's going to give them the ability to look directly at planets that are going around other stars. That's one of the many things that you can read about if you go to the right website. Okay, well, after that, Paul, by the way, we do get some very favorable mail. Let me drop. Some very favorable mail because Paul, for lots of years, has been studying, this is WS2N I'm talking about, has been studying what NASA does, and the favorable mail we get is that he gives us his plans on what it all means, what they're doing, and what to look forward to. There was a launch, for instance, on Saturday that took place, but we had local overcast, so I don't think anybody had a chance to see it at roughly 5 in the class, 5 in the afternoon, not yesterday. After John and Paul make their presentations, and after we do the first hour's worth of questions and answers, then we usually go into deeper subjects, and not necessarily ham radio. Turns out ham radio operators, in my opinion, inside of every good, serious ham radio operator, there's really a scientist trying to get out. They may not have the resources or the right occupation yet where he can actually practice that as his place of business, but still, with some of the experiments these guys do in their backyard or in their basement or in their second bedroom in the house are quite interesting. On top of that, I'm led to believe that most of the respected electrical engineering schools in the United States, among other places in the world, do, by my standards, a very poor bit of teaching on the subject of antenna design. The bottom line is that with high probability, if you really need an antenna designer, you better go get a serious ham radio operator who has been tinkering with it in his own backyard for a few years. To become an antenna designer requires, in my opinion, something like 10 or 15 years of apprenticeship. There are 5,000 different kinds of antennas. You open up the latest issue, let me drop it. You open up the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, which is in its fourth edition. The fourth edition is by Balakas. I think it's got 1,200 pages, something like 60 separate chapters by 60 separate groups of experts on just those individual subsets of antenna types. 5,000 kinds of antennas is my rough approximation. You take the average guy coming out of a good electrical engineering school, bachelor or master's degree, summa cum laude graduation, with a specialty in wireless communications. And as I have often done, you interview one of those guys and you ask him the question, roughly how many kinds of antennas do you think there are? You usually get an answer like 30, 40, or 50 types, sometimes 20. I believe there are 5,000 types. As you can tell, there's a lot more there than meets the eye. And when it comes to wireless technology, from my point of view, the way wireless techniques work is that you first start off with a good antenna that has proper performance, reasonable standing wave ratio, reasonable pattern, reasonable gain, reasonable efficiency. Then you hang some electronics on it, and you've got a transmitter and receiving system. If you did it the other way around, you build a good insulated, platinum made, highest technology transmitter or receiver, and don't connect it to an antenna, you've got nothing. You've got a beautiful piece of electronics on the table that can't do a thing. Where the rubber meets the road is the antenna. It's one of the most frequent subjects we discussed on the TechNet. Now you're getting a little bit of a hint as to why. I'm an antenna designer. Yes, I'm biased. I've got quite a few patents on antennas with my name on them over the last 10 years or so. So yes, I'm biased. And so to me, it's very important. And you talk to the guys who... You talk to the guys who've got a good working system where they've made some nice contacts, routed some good countries, done some good VHF, UHF work and whatever. And most likely one of the frequent subjects they'll discuss is the thing they're most proud of, what they did to homebrew that antenna. For quite a few years I used to enter the antenna gain competitions that were held by the East Coast VHF Society at Trenton State College, as it used to be called, in New Jersey. And for 10 or 15 years in a row, the highest performance antenna on those antenna gain competitions, when you get the 20 or so guys, 25 guys coming together, usually representing 5, 6, 7 states, coming together to measure their antennas in the field at Trenton State College. The winning antenna every one of those years was homebrew. The commercial products sometimes were very exciting as to how different there was, how much difference there was between their advertised performance and what was really measured in the real world. There was a particular Cushcraft antenna that claimed to have 16 dB of gain and measured 8. There was another antenna, I don't remember the brand name, that claimed 24 decibels of gain, a Yagi-like structure, and it measured 9 dB of gain. So what happens with television aerials and many other kinds of antennas is that the gain of the antenna is set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. As such, there's such a huge discrepancy between the claims and the reality, the smarter companies, smarter journals like QST Magazine, will no longer accept a gain claim in their advertisement because there's been so much fibbing going on, if you know what I mean. You want an antenna designer, you talk to a ham radio operator. All right, enough of that. The way a person signs into the TechNet when he's out... A person signs into the TechNet by giving us their call letters, their name, try to remember to give me the name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1445 of the series that began in September of 1982, very close to 51 or 52 TechNets per year for 30 and a half years. By now, we believe somebody is listening. It doesn't have to be proven to us. We also don't start off with that mysterious quote on very many nets. Is there anybody with emergency communication? There almost never is. I'm not quite sure why that one always exists. But a good sign-in would sound like this. KC2, RFN, Alan, and yes. Alan, by the way, is the man who volunteered the TechNet for the award that it received, the ARRL Board of Directors Technical Service Award for 2010, year 2010. Alan was the man who did the nomination, and that award was awarded on that particular year. Okay, give us your call letters and name right now, and the word yes if you've got a question or a comment for the net. K2LAW, and the group of the three of us, that means Paul, John, and Dick, we're listening. K2LAW.
WA2RY, Joe, yes.
Enter OBCN, one question for first hour, and one after Paul.
Okay, we've got Joe and we got Wes. Anybody else?
Whiskey, and here's Joe, number two, and yes.
Joe, number two, I heard Yankee Whiskey. Please give me the other part of it that I covered up by mistake. You got it, Joe, number two.
W, that's Glenn Paul with this space report. Good evening, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Joe, number two, ending with Yankee Whiskey. Please give me the full call.
Okay, roger that, roger that. This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. This is Joe, number two. How you guys doing out there? And yes, I do have a question.
We got you, Joe, number two. Not to worry. Okay, so far, Joe, number one. Joe, number two, Wes. Anyone else give me a question, with a question or a comment? Delta 2, Charlie X-ray Killer was what I got. And Craig, did I get that correct? QSL?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, we got more than enough to get going. Joe, Demetri, he usually does some darn interesting questions. A couple of times in the past, he asked us a question that took us a long time to give a reasonable answer to it. It was many facets, as I remember. So, what's going on in the South Shore of Long Island tonight, Joe? W2LYY, T2LIW in the Tech Nest.
Good evening, Dick. Well, I always try to keep you guys on your toes, especially you. You like, you love it. I'm thinking of putting some RF chokes on the snapper ring kind of chokes on the outside of a coax cable, especially the one I have a living constructor that has a ballast. And you said the snap-on chokes are good for keeping the RF off the outside of the cable. All right? And now what I've come up with is some different readings on these chokes from one particular vendor that makes these chokes. Let me read some of these things to you. Because the question is going to be, what do I go for? The biggest number is the better one? I'll read a group of these readings for you. The first group is rated like this. 20 ohm at 10 meg, 55 ohm at 25 meg, 130 ohm at 100 meg. The second group of chokes, 90 ohm at 10 meg, 150 at 25 meg, 220 ohm at 100 meg. And the third one, 25 ohm at 1 meg, 71 ohm at 5 meg, 100 ohm at 10 meg, 156 ohm at 25 meg, 260 ohm at 100 meg. That would happen to say type 31 mix, which I don't understand really what that means. So the ultimate question here is, what do you really go for? The biggest number is the better one, or what do you really do? You're trying to keep RF off the cable. So what's the object of the game here? Do you go for the biggest number or something in the medium range? What would you suggest you next? Back to you.
Okay, what I believe you're talking about is ferrite-like devices, if they happen to be in a toroid shape, or they could be in a more rectangular shape with us. It comes apart in two pieces, like jaws. You open up these jaws, you put your piece of wire through it one time or multiple times, and then you close the jaws. A little bit of an explanation for what's going on. By the way, the word type 31 mix is really talking about what are the components and the method of production of the actual ferrite-like material. The expert on that subject is Glenn Casey, 2QIQ. So when he signs in later on, we'll ask him.
Oh, here's Casey, 2QIQ.
What took you so long? Let me break off right now. The word type 31 mix, and I guarantee there's a zillion other mixes. What do those words mean, Glenn? And after Glenn tells us what it means, I'll give you a little bit of an explanation as to what is the magic when you put a ferrite device around a piece of wire. Why does it do something? Does the signal know the difference if it's a piece of coax cable, for instance, and the signal's flowing down the center of the coax cable? Does it know you put a piece of ferrite on the outside? The answer is no, but you still pick up a significant benefit. So, Glenn, type 31 mix ferrite. What means those words? KCQQIQ, our magnetics expert, K2RIW. Glenn is part of that brain power we've got in the tri-state area. You got it, Glenn.
It's type 31 mix is a brand name. There's a manufacturer called Ferrite, F-A-I-R-R-I-T-E. And they produce a lot of EMI-style magnetics, and they're good for basically building EMI filters. And what they're doing there is they're basically giving you the impedance of that choke with a fixed number of turns. They usually tell you the number of turns through the core, and they're giving you what the attenuation is of that choke usually when it's used with a capacitor or some other element, so you can get an idea of attenuation. So type 31 mix is basically just if you look in a ferrite catalog, you'll see like a whole group of different ferrites that they offer, and it just so happens that one particular blend is called Type 31. There's other ones called like 77, 71 that I'm very familiar with. 31 just happens to be one of the EMI mixers deck. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
But again, at which frequency? Because that I don't understand. Impedance at what?
Hold on now, you're getting ahead of the game here, Wes. Step by step, we're going to get there. Roughly what do you believe is the mu of type 31? Make a guess on that one, Glenn. And then I'm going to jump into a little bit of Wes's asking. When we measure the mu, I presume it's at a particular frequency, and I believe most of these materials, once you read the data sheet on the material, like ferrite 31, type 31, my guess is by the time you get to a frequency like, I'm going to pick a number, 1,000 megahertz, my guess is that permeability goes into a very different lower number. So make a rough guess. Type 31, at the frequencies we're talking about right now, what's your guess as to its approximate permeability or mu? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I would imagine if you measured this thing down in the, with like a few hundred kilohertz or so, in other words, with like a bridge, you probably see the mu is pretty high. It's probably somewhere in the order of like, you know, 2,000 or that area. And then as you go up in frequency, like where these things are used as RF chokes, the mu is probably somewhere around between 25 and 100 dick. So they're not very, very high permeability, as you were saying. And the higher and higher you go in frequency, the one advantage to these materials is they are good attenuators, but they also become very, very lossy. So you kind of have to be careful in some power circuits if you're going to use them, especially in like VHF and UHF, that they can get very, very warm if you run a lot of power through them. There are some better choices for using for balance. I wouldn't use in EMI because they're more like sponges. They absorb a lot of energy. Let it drop for a second. The better choices for balance chokes are probably ones that have a distributed air gap inside of them, like the magnetic sink mix, what they call MPP cores. The MPP cores, you can get those in permeabilities of like 60 to 100, and they have, they basically have the nickel mix in nickel, manganese, and ferrite, kind of like all mixed together. There's a distributed air gap. And those toroids are excellent for use in HF through VHF, and even in the low UHF for balance. You can run a fair amount of power through them, and they don't saturate from something like 10,000 Gauss. So they won't get very, very warm and have a very, very good saturation characteristic for balance. But the other cores that Joe was talking about are better for really for EMI filter applications. Like if you're building a filter and you want to filter out the EMI, but you could get warm and high power. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What distributed air gap stands for?
Hold on now, you're jumping ahead. We're going to get to all of that. There'll be a time for the question and answer. This is probably going to be a 10-minute or so of a series of lectures. You guys have heard a lot of technical terms. I'm going to try to explain a few of them. Now let's start off at the very beginning. I've got a piece of, pick a number, 18-gauge wire sitting on the table. And I got the piece of 18-gauge wire laying a quarter of an inch above my ground plane. And I'm wiring between transistor number one and transistor number two, and there's a piece of wire there, which maybe downrange is going to have a resistor or a capacitor, but I'm just talking about the piece of wire all by itself. Every piece of wire in any reasonable environment has built-in inductance. Very rough rule of thumb that many people use, the technicians have been using it for decades, 22 nanohenries per inch. Every single piece of wire in a reasonable environment has an inductance of 22 nanohenries per inch. What that really means is that if you use the so-called right-hand rule, if I know that the current is flowing from left to right on that piece of wire in front of me, and I hold that piece of wire in my hand with my fingers wrapped around it, my thumb parallel to the piece of wire, and my thumb is pointing in the direction where the current is flowing. Whenever current flows through a piece of wire, by definition, by Faraday's law, so to speak, it will create a magnetic field. And what does the magnetic field look like? Let me drop. I've got a reasonably long piece of wire in my hand, just as an example. My thumb is pointing in the direction where the current is flowing. My fingers wrap around the wire, showing you exactly how the magnetic field lines wrap around the wire. They're completely permeability is something that describes how easily does a magnetic field flow through the substance of interest. By definition, a permeability of one unity is air. Air is your basis for describing permeability. These ferrite materials, whether they powdered iron ferrite of various mixtures, various chemistries, various air gaps inside, various methods of construction, various layouts, large, small, big, fine-grained, coarse-grained, whatever. These materials all have a property called permeability. In the case of what Glenn just told us is that when you're down at a very low frequency, the Type 31 mix might have a mu, the letter, the Greek letter mu, looks like a kind of an M, and that symbol stands for permeability. When he said it had a permeability of 2,000, that's a fancy way of saying a magnetic field at that frequency, DC up to that frequency, so to speak, will flow through that material 2,000 times better than it flows through air. That's what permeability of 2,000 means. Okay? So now I've got a piece of coax cable. Because of the way I'm using the piece of coax cable, I know that the circuit that's the load at the far end of it, let me drop it, might not be an ideal shielded load. I mean, the most ideal situation is you got a piece of coax cable that comes out of the back of your shielded box of your transmitter, and it goes over to the shielded box that's called your antenna tuner. That would be the most ideal situation where everything is shielded. Well, that's the way we'd like everything to be, but when it comes to something like an antenna, where you might be taking the coax cable and feeding a dipole antenna, and you could start off with the quick and dirty way where the shield goes to the left side of the dipole and the antenna conductor goes to the right side. The dipole wants to be a balanced circuit. You've launched power into it. And as such, half of the energy is going to go to the right side, half the energy is going to go to the left side of the dipole. Therefore, because of the way the dipole behaves, because it wants to be a balanced circuit, half the energy on each side, it will, because of the interconnection of the shield on the left side of the dipole in my example, it will be launching current back down the coax cable. And you want to choke off that current, okay? Once you put this ferrite material around the coax cable, the current that wants to flow down the outside of the coax shield is, in my definition, making a magnetic field. Now you're going to aim your thumb to the left, so to speak. It's coming back down the cable. The current, your fingers wrapping around the coax cable, show you the way that the magnetic field, due to the current flowing in the cable, wants to flow. You put the ferrite material there. And if at your particular frequency, the ferrite material had a permeability, a mu of, pick a number, 100, that means that the magnetic field created by the current flowing on the outside of the cable, that magnetic field is going to flow through your ferrite bead or your ferrite toroid that you put around the cable. That magnetic field is going to flow 100 times better than it would through the air. As such, the magnetic field is now confining itself, so to speak.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The magnetic field is confining itself to that ferrite material. Therefore, the amount of inductance per length, assume now it's not quite right, but assume your cable still had 22 nanohenries per inch. In reality, it's going to be a little bit lower because it's a larger diameter object. 22 nanohenries per inch multiplied by the permeability of 100 means you get 2,200 millihenries per inch. In other words, your coaxial cable, because it's going through a piece of ferrite, suddenly acts as if it has a huge amount of inductance, 100 times higher inductance than it had before.
Can I explain that a little bit better?
Yeah, in a second I'll give it to you. So once the cable has a higher inductance, that really means that the inductance is a fancy way of saying that at that operating frequency, it's like going to a higher resistor. The current has a greater degree of difficulty flowing through it. The ferrite material starts acting like an RF choke. That's based on the assumption that just got the ferrite, I've got the coax cable going through this toroid of ferrite material once. In theory, I can wrap a few turns. And now, assuming that all the magnetic field stays inside of your ferrite material, I take the number of turns and square it. If I was able to put, let me pick a number, 3 turns of coax through that toroid, 3 squared is 9, I'm now getting 9 times the amount of inductance I would with it just flowing straight through. You can see there's all kinds of magic do here once you see the principle of operation. There's many ways of looking at it. The lines of magnetic field, like your fingers wrapping around the cable, and that magnetic field inside the starlight flowing 100 times better than it does through air, gives you a little bit of a feeling for why the cable suddenly acts like it's got a huge amount of inductance in that vicinity where it goes through the toroid. KC2QIQ, how do you view this one, Glenn? KQRIW in the deck there.
Just the other thing that I want to add to that is about this, what makes the magnetic field flow better in the ferrite? What does that mean? Well, I'm going to add a couple of words to that. Basically, if you look at permeability of one, what is the permeability of one? Like you said, there's a piece of wire, and let's say you have a DC current in that wire, and you were to view the magnetic lines of flux around that wire. They have a certain pattern of those lines of flux that naturally arrange themselves in free space. When you wrap a piece of ferrite around that wire, what you're doing is you're realigning those magnetic lines of flux. So instead of letting them have their normal pattern where they would have a permeability of one, what it does is the core itself with a higher permeability realigns all of those lines of flux and basically draws them in instead of going into large looping around that wire of magnetic lines of flux. Now they're nice and tight within the core, and they're very, very close to the wire. So now what you've done is you've concentrated those magnetic lines of flux closely around the wire. And the higher the number of permeability, basically that means how many times you're realigning those lines of flux so that they're more intensified in a very, very small area around the wire. That's why you'd need a long length of wire, 22 nanohenries per inch, to build up any kind of inductance for the low drop. But by simply adding a core around the wire with the magnetic lines of flux all rearranged in a very, very small area, you don't need that long length anymore. You don't need, 22 nanohenries per inch. Now, in 1 inch, you could get, microhenries, hundreds of microhenries, because of the intensified magnetic lines of flux through mu. Back to you, Vic. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn, and that's completing the picture a little bit more. So, the mu material, the material having permeability many times higher than air, means that the magnetic field finds the equivalent of a short circuit. In other words, it decides to flow there as opposed to the outside world. It concentrates locally the magnetic lines of flux inside of the ferrite material. Believe it or not, the ferrite material is a fairly good shield for magnetic field. The magnetic field flows there as opposed to going beyond. If you were sitting outside of that coax cable, let me pick a number, 6 inches away, measuring the amount of magnetic field that was there in the natural environment, then you add the ferrite material there, all of a sudden you're going to find out it acts as a concentrator, and the magnetic field in the ferrite doesn't get beyond, it doesn't bother going back to the outside air anymore, it doesn't want to go there. It's found a much better environment to flow through, that concentrator. That's the good news. So one turn or multiple turns through the ferrite with its magnetic field concentration drastically increasing the amount of inductance, that's really the AC equivalent of resistance, if you know what I mean. If I've got at my particular operating frequency, if I have an inductive reactance of, let me pick a number, 100 ohms, that means for each ampere that I want to flow through the cable, I'm going to get 100 volts of drop through the cable, right where the cable is going through the ferrite bead, so to speak, and therefore a hell of a lot of the current no longer flows further down the cable, or it doesn't get a chance to flow in the first place because you've drastically increased the impedance of that circuit. Alrighty, that's the good news. Now you have to accept the fact that every ferrite material has a limitation. The good news about air, the bad news about air is it's only got a permeability of one. It's our reference for how easily you can establish a magnetic field. Let me drop. And the other good piece of magnetic field news about air is that air does not saturate. You can make a stronger and stronger and stronger magnetic field if you have the resources. And there are laboratories that can make magnetic fields that are so strong that they are lethal. You put a human head in there, and you probably wouldn't survive it. And you try to drop a a piece of copper pipe through it. It takes a half an hour to go through the magnet, so to speak, because of the reluctance of what's going on, the backing enough, if you know what I mean. So you can make huge, strong magnetic fields in air. Air does not saturate. That's the good news. The good news about ferrite is that it's a huge concentrator. The magnetic field flows through it many times better than it does through air. That's the good news. The bad news of ferrite, two pieces of bad news you have to accept as a limitation. Number one, it's frequency sensitive. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, depending on the method that you've constructed the ferrite material, what are your individual grain sizes, are they insulated from each other at the microscopic level, do they create local eddy currents? As you go to higher and higher frequencies, almost all materials will go to a lower and lower amount of reluctance, a lower and lower amount of permeability is the word I'm looking for. So the mu number goes to a lower number as you go up in frequency. Depending on what frequency you're operating at, you have to select the one that's appropriate for you. That's disadvantage number one. Can we drop? Disadvantage number two is that every piece of material with a permeability higher than air has a certain level of magnetic field at which it saturates. I may want to put 10 amperes of current through that particular piece of ferrite, and the wire that's going near that piece of ferrite, it creates a certain amount of magnetic field, and maybe that doesn't saturate the core. And if I now decide to put, instead of 10 amperes, I put 20 amperes, I'm doubling the amount of magnetic field. If I go beyond the stated performance, that's one of the specifications you read on the manufacturer's data sheet, he'll tell you how strong a magnetic field your material will tolerate before it saturates. He'll tell you also at what frequency you can go to and what loss tangent it'll have. In other words, as you go near saturation, as you go to stronger magnetic fields, as you go to higher frequencies, all ferrite material has a certain amount of loss to it, a certain amount of resistive loss. It'll get hot. And if you use it within specifications, the amount of heat is tolerable. It doesn't create permanent damage, and everything's hunky-dory. But it's one of the many things that if you're really a serious designer, you want to know about. What frequency, what magnetic field it saturates at, what permeability is left when you go there. And as you go to further and further saturation of ferrite material, unless it's a very exotic kind, you get more and more loss. You go to a high enough magnetic field where instead of running your transmitter at the 10-watt level where you designed it, you're running at 500-watt level, and your particular ferrite bead and your particular coax acting as the balance up at the antenna is hitting saturation, getting hot. You could be permanently damaging the ferrite material, changing it to something else because you've overheated it. And while it's saturating, it could be making other spurious signals. Believe it or not, a passive piece of magnetic material that goes into saturation, we look at the output result on a spectrum.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You look at the output result on a spectrum analyzer. When you've got saturated magnetic fields, you will find harmonic frequency being generated by the saturation phenomenon. The fact that saturation is a nonlinear effect, one of the many things that can happen. Now, when it comes to filter choke and other kinds of ferrite materials that you're using, if you're really smart, you can go to the next step. You can put air gaps in just the right spot that lowers the amount of saturation. Therefore, you can tolerate higher currents. But as you add an air gap in your ferrite material, yes, you can put a stronger amount of current through it before you hit saturation. But with the air gap, the total magnetic path now has the high permeability ferrite material during portions of the path. But the air gap represents a portion where the magnetic field must jump through that air gap in air, where the permeability is 1. Therefore, the overall inductance of your circuit is decreasing when you add the air gap. So the air gap is another one of those compromises. Give us a couple of words on how they usually choose the amount of air gap in the material to try to control the saturation at a particular frequency for a particular application. Give me a few words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ,
K2LIW
on the TechNet.
So then, is the distributed air gap stands for the physical air gap or it's something else?
The word air gap goes back to the early days of transformer design, where it means physical air gap. In other words, there's a space in the magnetic path. In other words, if you were to look at, like, let's take, for instance, a toroid. Toroid, most people are familiar with, the little donut shape. And if you were to cut a small section out of that toroid, you'd create an air gap in that toroid. What would happen is your inductance would drop, like Dick just mentioned, depending on how big that air gap is in that magnetic field, in that air gap that you just cut into the core. But the inductance will drop, but you'll be able to run it at higher magnetic flux intensities without the material saturating. Let me let it drop. So in the early days, when they used to use all different types of shapes, mainly especially like E-cores, and they would gap the transformers or E-cores of ferrite and or also steel. In the old EC60 cycle magnetics, basically they would put air gaps inside there as well to alleviate saturation problems. And further on in magnetic material development, as years went by, they started finding ways instead of making the, taking a solid piece of steel or ferrite and putting a physical air gap inside of it, they could start grinding the magnetic material up and put it in, mix it with binders, like glues and other materials, ceramics, and by doing that, they could separate the ferrite in some kind of like a saturated mix of ceramic and distribute the ferrite material in the ceramic. And the ceramic basically, because it doesn't have magnetic properties, basically looks like an air gap, but it still keeps the material solid, so it looks like you're still holding a solid core, but there is actually distributed air gaps all around the material. I think that covers it, Vic. Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
So the glue or the binder or the ceramic, whatever is holding your toroid or your chunks of ferrite material together, once you choose the grain size, once you decide how much of the ferrite material as a powder you're going to mix in the process of building this, which really gives you a recipe, which once you know the density of your powder, ferrite powder that you're adding, you can estimate how much air gap is going to be around each little chunk. So that's a distributed air gap. You end up with a material with higher frequency capability, lower permeability, but higher saturation characteristics. So this is one of the many variables. As you can tell, you've got a whole lot of knobs to this particular piece of equipment, so to speak, called ferrite. What is the actual powdered iron or ferrite material? What is it made out of? What components it has? Is it iron, magnesium, nickel, and whatever? That's part of it. How fine are the grains? What is the grain to binder ratio? What is the shape it's got? And when it comes to the amount of inductance that you get that, of these various frequencies that Joe gave us in the very beginning, that's on the assumption that one piece of wire goes through one chunk of that material, and you're making a measurement of that frequency, and that manufacturer is telling you that this is the number of ohms of inductive reactance you'll get. Like one of his statements there was that you'll get 90 ohms of inductive reactance at 10 megacycles for one of the kinds of material when you use one of them and you put one wire through it. Now, there's nothing stopping you from putting more than one piece of ferrite material cascaded down that piece of cable. You don't have to just put one. You can put two, three, four, or five. You can put the coax cable through it more than one time, wrap it multiple turns. If you put that all together, you go to page 46.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you go to page 46 of the May issue of QST Magazine, May 2013, go to page 46, you see this article entitled, An Easy to Build High Impedance Choke Balance. What this guy has done is he started off with a nice large piece of ferrite in a toroid shape. He didn't put one of them together. He stacked five of them together, held together with tie wraps. Then he put a piece of RG8 coax cable through it, not once, but put it through it five times. He wrapped five turns through five consecutive cores. By the fact that he used more than one core, by the fact that he used more than one turn, means that he built up a huge amount of inductive reactance. And that particular ferrite choke for his high-power antenna, I believe he's claiming that it works on 80 through 10 meters inclusive, and I think it's got moderately good performance, even at 160 meters. As you go to lower and lower frequencies, where the same amount of ferrite material is going to give you a different amount of reactants, the way an inductor usually works, where the inductive reactance is that formula, X sub L, that means inductive reactance in ohms, equals 2 pi FL. 2 pi is a constant, 6.28, times frequency times inductance in Henry's. You multiply that together, and once you know the properties of your material, you can estimate how many Henry's or micro Henry's and nano Henry's you're going to get for one turn, and you can sometimes put multiple turns. So this guy's put it all together. Five chunks of ferrite, five turns, and he's mounted it all in a piece of PVC pipe with beautiful weatherproofing. So he's got a very strong physical structure, taking great big pieces of RG8 coax cable, five turns through it, mounted it up near the junction of his...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
He made it mechanically strong enough so that he can hang this device sort of like the balance you can buy, but this is a much stoochier one than the ones you can buy. That could be the center support for a inverted V dipole, and the inverted V dipole could be a fan dipole that gives it performance on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, and maybe 160 meters. So, lots of good information there. So, now, Joe's original question is that he's got these various choices for the number of ohms he's going to get with one piece of wire through these ferrite materials at these individual frequencies. Let me drop. So, the manufacturer has given him a pretty good amount of information by which he can make some prediction as to how it's going to perform in his environment. Once Joe knows what frequency he's operating at, he should also look a little bit further to find out at the power level he's running, is he going to run into a saturation problem? He's probably going to dig deeper into the data sheet of that manufacturer. If the manufacturer is telling you as to what power level it's going to saturate at, he can also decide that he's going to put more than one turn. The opposite of common sense is that as you add multiple turns, in many circumstances, the current goes down because of the multiple turns, because the inductance builds up, and what used to be a saturating situation can easily become a non-saturating situation because you've added multiple turns or multiple pieces of ferrite. So I know you didn't get an exact answer to your original question, Joe, but I think in the process we've covered a little bit more of the material and removed a little bit more of the mystery. When you speak to the average electronic engineer coming out of a good electrical engineering school, the whole subject of magnetics really is a fuzzy chunk of memorized formulas. Let me drop. He usually walks out of that college with a whole bunch of formulas in his head with reference to magnetics. He usually gets very little lab work, very little hands-on experience of using magnetic materials. So the whole subject of magnetics is a bit of a mystery. You take the guy graduating with a bachelor degree, good electrical engineering school, and he's the top guy in the class. And you say, okay, I'm designing a 60-cycle transformer. I want it to be efficient. I want to put 120 volts of 60-cycle AC into the primary, and I want to get a center tap 15.5 volts coming out of the secondary. Can you do that design for me? You hand that information to a graduating electronic engineer, and he knows something about the turns ratio between primary that's going to do that. But when it comes to selecting the actual magnetic core material on which he's going to wind that transformer, he's very befuddled, with rare exception. So the bottom line is that, in my opinion, the way we teach antennas, the way we teach magnetics, can be done a hell of a lot better because the average engineer can't do it. I mean, let me pass back to Glenn for a comment on that. My guess is it takes a fair amount of apprenticeship for the guy to get a warm, fuzzy feeling on what magnetic materials he can choose for what particular magnetic application. Is there some truth in that one, Glenn? ACQQIQ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I mean, certainly when I first started off in engineering, I did not know how to design a transformer coming out of engineering school. And I can tell you that it was one of the dirty jobs where I was working, and I was working as the understudy, as an apprentice, and luckily I had guys like Frank Greenhall and other people that basically showed me how to do it, and had designed transformers. And of course, you know, I got better at it. Then there's another guy named Ridley, who was Dr. Ridley, who was another fantastic individual who gave me a lot of hints in that area as well early on. But yeah, I mean, when you're first coming out of college, I'm not sure that really colleges are that specialized in a lot of these areas, and maybe they shouldn't be. I think if your mathematics background is good enough, your physics background is good enough, your chemistry background is good enough, you need to get out in the field and get the hands-on before you're going to really experience these things. Let me drill it. Drop for a second. I think that through working in the industry, you'll eventually get there. I mean, I do know that there is master's studies. When you get into your master's level courses, you're definitely going to see much more in the way of magnetics, and I'm quite sure that there is, master's level courses that deal more with antennas and other things. So at that level, but certainly I think working in the industry is certainly going to give you your best knowledge, and that's where the equipment is, too. I mean, usually universities never have the lab equipment that a company has. You know, you're not going to get LaCroix scopes and the best HP stuff and Agilent and all the top equipment in the universities. You're going to have to get out in the industry to see that bit. K2RW, K2QIQ.
Notice what you guys just heard. By my standards, one of the smartest electronic engineers we've got in Long Island is a guy named Glenn, KC2QIQ. He comes out of a real good school, a head full of knowledge. Notice that he needed Frank Greenhall and Dr. Ridley as mentors who took them under his wing, and he was an apprentice, and they taught him magnetics. As you can see, the fact that many of you guys out there feel uncomfortable with magnetics. You don't quite know how a magnetic field flows. You don't know how to design circuits that need magnetics. You're in good company. Many of us were there. I started off in the exact same sort of a situation where I needed a 15.5-volt transformer for the piece of transistorized transmitter I had just designed, and I wanted it to be compact, and in those days, this was 1960 roughly, you couldn't walk into Radio Shack, it didn't exist, you couldn't walk into, some of the other places, you could walk into Lafayette Radio, you couldn't walk into Arrow Electronics and say, I need a transistorized power supply transformer, 15.5-volt Cenotaph. They'd look at you and say, what the hell is that? I mean, diodes and transistors were just becoming popular in those days. And here I had to wind my own. And I started off with an audio output transformer. I found out by experimenting on the table, I found that I could take the audio output transformer, I could put 120 volts, 60 cycles into the primary, it didn't burn up, and I could wind my own turns on the secondary until I got the right voltage. I did it by cut and try. And so as long as you start off with a 60-watt light bulb in series with 110-volt line going into the transformer, so you're limiting the current that flows, as long as you're careful not to electrocute yourself, what we amateurs are extremely good at doing is cut and try experimentation, find out what works, and
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you do it carefully, you don't have to create any damage or a fire or whatever. And so we amateurs are willing to do that. We're willing to open up the cabinet on that piece of radio equipment and do troubleshooting. So I know you didn't get the exact answer you're looking for, Joe, but hopefully some of this information gives you a little bit more feeling for what's going on. Which one of those materials is the ideal? There is no good answer. Every one of them is a compromise. You've got to decide that for your particular frequency, this one is cheap enough, big enough, looks like it can do it, and I can then decide to use multiple pieces of it or multiple turns through it in order to get the full performance I'm looking for. When it comes to choking the amount of current flowing down the outside of a coax cable, if at your operating frequency, let me pick a number, 500 ohms of inductive reactance,
of the tail end of your coax cable where it meets the antenna, and the antenna is a 70 ohm piece, and you can create 500 ohms of inductance at your frequency at that position in space, you've probably done a very good job. Not perfect, but good enough to choke the current from flowing back down that cable. Give you a little bit of a working example there, Joe. To meet you RYY, or you sent us on a beauty tonight show, get you RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it sounds to me like you said the bigger number is the better number to go for, because the last group of numbers that I had, type 31 mix, that was 25 ohm, I guess it's open XL at 1 meg, 71 at 5 meg, 100 ohms at 10 meg, 156 at 25 meg, which are basically cover all the RF frequencies for HF. So that's probably what I'm going to probably try. I'll probably try a few of those chokes, and I may also try the suggestion you suggested of trying not only a few chokes on, but trying multiple wraps of coax wrapped around underneath the ballast. I'll try this to see how this actually works, and then I'll get back to you when I get the thing constructed. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Joe. And it's in your library, or if you don't already get it, you can see the May issue 2013 QSD magazine, and look at page 46. You'll get some other beautiful mechanical construction ideas on what you're trying to do. Okay, the next guy who had a question was Joe number 2, was it? Yes, I think it was. KC2QYW, Kilo Charlie 2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, Joe number 2, go right ahead, K2RIW in the second hand.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Yeah, this question, it's really not amateur related, but my question is, when stuff falls from space, like it could be space junk, whatever, asteroids or whatever, is it true, like the first responder, the first response will be people from NASA, like they're the ones that will like pick up the stuff and bring it back to their base. Is that true? Because I saw something on TV about back in 1965 about a UFO crash out in Pennsylvania, and that was my question.
Turns out the Earth is a very large object with a lot of local gravity. Space has, if you add up all the little microscopic pieces of junk floating around, there's a lot of stuff in space. Therefore, the Earth is continuously, as it goes around the Sun, sweeping up this material. It falls into the gravity well called Earth. Quite often, this material might start off at a lunar distance or 50 times a lunar distance. By the time it hits the Earth, it's continuously falling toward the Earth. It can easily pick up some very high velocities, like 40,000 miles an hour. Most of the stuff that hits the Earth is grains of sand in size, sometimes very low in density. These little pieces of grains of sand hitting the Earth at, let me pick a number, 40,000 miles an hour, hits the atmosphere, burns up, and gives you what you and I would call a meteor, a falling star. You'd be amazed how small most of those are. Although that one that hit in Russia a few months ago was really massive. I mean, that's a once per 100-year event. And because of its size, because of its velocity, it hit the atmosphere with a whole lot of kinetic energy, experienced a whole lot of air compression heating as it hit that atmosphere. That in turn, whenever you heat up the atmosphere, air expands when it gets hot from the drop. So this expanding air that's superheated by the impact of this meteor hitting the atmosphere, this very massive, high-velocity object, created so much local heat, which constitutes a shock wave, not very different from exploding a pyrotechnic device.